From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So what you find really are women working as very cheap, dispensable labor and at very low levels with almost inhuman conditions of employment.
As we can see, and you can see in your own country, that a lot of the wealthy get wealthier and a lot of the poor get poorer.
But the more women participate, the more they're going to be presidents. And the more women show that they are making a difference in agenda, the more they're going to help to change their own countries.
It's Women's History Month. Today, we map our progress around the world. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq will abide by an agreement to open suspected weapon sites to UN teams, but the inspection should be completed as swiftly as possible. This, according to the nation's UN ambassador. The 15-member Security Council will meet today to consider a U.S.-backed resolution warning of very severe consequences if Baghdad breaks the accord. Earlier drafts had said severest consequences. The resolution, submitted by Britain and Japan, endorsed the agreement by UN Chief Kofi Annan that reduced the possibility of a military strike by the United States and Britain. Ambassador Nizar Hamdoun, who participated in the talks with Annan, acknowledged that the agreement contains no time limit for inspections of 8 presidential compounds, which the Iraqis had placed off limits. Hamdoun also told CNN that Iraq expected the diplomats to be in charge of the inspections teams, a comment that drew a sharp reply from Richard Butler, the chief UN weapons inspector. Butler told CNN it was perfectly clear in the accord that general responsibility was his and that inspection reports would go from him through Annan to the Security Council. A former inspector, David Kaye, said on NBC's Meet the Press that the requirement to send diplomats along with inspectors would be a serious impediment to effective inspections. A Senate Foreign Affairs subcommittee today will look at the possibility of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Lawmakers from both parties say the Iraqi leader should be removed from power. Several senators appeared on talk shows yesterday calling for programs aimed at toppling Saddam. Nebraska Democrat Bob Kerry told NBC the U.S. objective should be liberating the Iraqi people from the terror of Saddam's dictatorship. And Republicans John McCain of Arizona and Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania also called for Saddam's removal. But White House National Security Advisor Sandy Berger says not so fast. Writing in yesterday's Washington Post, Berger reminded those who want to overthrow Saddam by proxy that the U.S. did not do well in supporting anti-government movements in Hungary in 1956, Cuba in 1961, or Iraq in 1991. The United States should take a lesson from Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and act a little crazy to keep enemies at bay. This, according to an internal military report made public yesterday, it was reported in today's New York Post. The fact that some elements of the U.S. government may appear out of control can be beneficial to creating and reinforcing fears and doubts within the minds of an adversary's decision makers, the report says. It goes on to say that the U.S. may become irrational and vindictive if its vital interests are attacked. Should be a part of the national persona we project to all adversaries. The report added that it hurts the United States to appear too fully rational and cool-headed. The previously secret report, entitled Essentials of Post-Cold War Deterrence, was written in 1995 by the Defense Department's Strategic Command, known as STRATCOM, the military headquarters responsible for the country's nuclear weapons. It was obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by the London-based Arms Control Group, the British-American Security Information Council. The group cited the report as an example of the Pentagon's push to keep its nuclear arsenal alive and kicking long after the Cold War with the Soviet Union has thawed. Iraq held a funeral procession through Baghdad today for 43 children it said died as a result of economic sanctions. A line of taxis carried their coffins wrapped in white cloth and bearing pictures of the dead infants from Martyr Square along the colonnades of Rashid Street in central Baghdad to a demonstration outside a United Nations office. sending out diplomatic feelers to end an increasingly costly military involvement in southern Lebanon. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today that his country is ready to comply with the United Nations resolution calling on it to withdraw if Lebanon cooperates in ensuring security along the border. And Congress on Wednesday will take its biggest step ever in giving Puerto Rico the chance to become America's 51st state. The House will vote on a bill that requires Puerto Rico to hold a referendum before year's end on whether the island will become a state or an independent nation or retain its Commonwealth status. The bill is expected to pass easily. It has the support of House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Republican of Georgia, House Democratic Leader Richard Gephardt, and President Clinton. And U.S., Russian, and Portuguese representatives were due to hold talks today with President Eduardo Dos Santos and Jonas Savimbi, leader of the former rebel group UNITA, which was supported by the U.S. and South Africa, to push forward the stalled peace process. That's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. I got my tongue, got my chin, got my neck. Today is the second day of Women's History Month, and on this day in New York, there's going to be a major presentation of the state of women around the world. It's being presented by WEDO, Women's Environment and Development Organization, at the United Nations. We're joined right now by a group of women who have gathered from around the world to be at the United Nations today for a presentation of this report and also to be there for the Commission on the Status of Women. We're going to start with Bella Abzug. She is the president and co-founder of WEDO, also former congresswoman from New York, well-known international feminist and wonderful woman. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you. Nice being here.
Tell us about this report that you've done, which is called Mapping Progress, Assessing Implementation of the Beijing Platform.
Well, I think this is a very auspicious moment. Not only is it Women's History Month, but we also celebrate International Women's Day on March 8th, because it is 2 years, or 2.5 years after Beijing. This is the fifth monitoring report that we've done. Governments have been much more responsive than in any other experience I've had in the more than 20 years that I've been working with the UN. Both governments and the national organizations of women, known as NGOs, have put together what they have accomplished since Beijing. Usually people are quite cynical and they say, oh, well, another conference, more words, what does it all mean? Well, this is one time where there's been a tremendous amount of pressure from the us, of course, we do, but from many organizations of women in their own countries saying, this has got to be not just words, as I like to say. We've had lots of words. Now we want the music, which is the action. And we have, this is our fifth report. And in each report, we have found more and more governments responding, so that now 70%, is it, of the governments have responded and have some form of national action plan. What the Beijing provided was an action program, and one of its provisions, 297, said that every government should develop its own national action plan based upon the Beijing plan of action. In fact, in this country, some of you may remember that we had a contract, so to speak, and we said, when the conference was over, people said to me, in the press, what does this all mean? I said, this is a contract with the world's women. It's not legally enforceable, but it's politically enforceable. And that's exactly what has happened. Women have come out in large numbers to demand of their governments their own plan of action. We have one here in the United States, by the way. And this is happening, as I said, 70% of the programs. And countries.
What do you mean, though, when you say plan of action?
A whole agenda for the lives of women. We're going to be discussing not only human rights, which is a big emphasis of the Commission on the Status of Women. We're discussing their needs and concerns, economic, political, social, their needs for peace, their needs for changes in who makes the decision. It's time to have that important participation of women. As I have always said, we have done almost everything in pairs since Noah, except govern, and this has been a very serious problem for the world, and now this is a way to change it. Governments are being pressured to have more women participating and also developing legislative plans and action plans. I mean, as we move into the 21st century, I have always said this will be the century of the women. It's our time to take over. And so I'm very pleased to be able to be here with this group that on this roundtable, who are essentially the leadership in the Women's Environment Development Organization. They come from many parts of the world.
And yet, before we move on to everyone else, one of the things that is clearly outlined in the report is that women in terms of governing, actually, in many parts of the world, percentages of women leaders who have been elected have gone down.
It hasn't gone down, but it hasn't really gone up. However, there is much stirring. And along with demanding an agenda from the governments and action has been the demand for participation. And you see in many, many areas of the world, in Africa and Asia, and in the Pacific and all over the world, you see more and more women who are organizing to become political, to become the decision makers, to share the political space. My friend Mim Kelber, who is our co-founder, has always said the world is suffering from a global nervous breakdown. We think they are too. And we think it's time for women who come with a new spirit, a new sense of what, a new vision, a new belief in a transformation, that it must be a world at peace with environmental precautions, a world that is recognizing human rights, a world that cares about economic justice, which, by the way, is a very important issue. Though much progress has been made, some of the progress that could have been made in the country since Beijing has been significantly hampered by globalization policies, which have seriously withdrawn support, financial and otherwise, for women in their social program and their needs and this agenda that they're putting together.
Bella Abzug, now the president of Women's Environment and Development Organization, known as WEDO, which is making its presentation at the United Nations today. In addition to Bella sitting around her kitchen table, we're joined by women from India, from Africa, from South America, and from the Caribbean. We're going to turn now to Bharati Sadashivam, and she's program coordinator for women's rights. She's from India, and she's the editor of this report. Following up on what Bella was just saying about economic parity, about the issue of globalization, that's something you focused on in this report.
I'd like to just go back to what Bella said initially about the power of women's movements. This report shows really incremental progress on what governments have been doing since 1995 to fulfill women's commitments. And what this report clearly shows is that 74% of governments have consulted NGOs in drawing up the national action plans. There are 58 countries with new policies and laws to address women's rights in various areas. The maximum number of laws have come about in domestic violence and safety, and here women's groups have had a phenomenal impact. There's just no other word to describe the way women's groups have been persistent and persevered in pushing governments to change discriminatory laws and to bring in laws that address all kinds of inequalities in safety, in issues of spousal abuse, in issues of rape within marriage, in issues of safety on the streets. And the maximum number of laws, that's 28 countries, have new laws in this area. To go back to globalization, this is obviously the underpinning theme of this report, because on the one hand, we have governments all over the world talking about making commitments to women's rights and human development, and at the same time pursuing policies that go completely contrary to what would advance women's rights and women's health. So what we're finding is that in many countries, especially countries like even developed industrialized countries like the US, Canada, UK, and even Sweden and Norway, that there are very strong trends towards fiscal austerity measures and economic restructuring programs that take a heavy toll on social sector spending, especially health, education, and employment. And women, who are very often the maximum number of users of public health services and also the largest number of employees in the health sector and in the public sector, are the first to lose. And the report on Canada especially is a very vivid description on how women are bearing the brunt of a lot of the economic policies being followed by governments.
You have a strong statement in your executive summary where you say, women are the shock absorbers of adjustment efforts and bear a disproportionate burden of the costs of transition. You go on to say, just as you were saying, evidence is inescapable from the reports of women in Africa, Asia, Europe, Latin America, North America, the Caribbean, and the Pacific Islands. But could you explain more specifically, perhaps in the example you just used of Canada, how women are hurt? Because many might say, and this goes to the issue of feminization of employment, that under globalization policies, women actually get jobs.
Yes, this is actually a very common argument advanced to support a lot of the globalization policies followed today across the world. Certainly, the globalization and restructuring has, to a large extent, advanced women's employment, especially in some sectors like manufacturing, export-oriented processing zones, and factory employment in general. But the numbers don't tell the whole story, because you may have a lot of women in these jobs, but they work in the most exploitative of conditions. In many countries, the governments have withdrawn from international labor conventions just so that they can be more sort of malleable to the international demands for cheap and docile labor. So what you find really are women working as very cheap, dispensable labor and at very low levels with almost inhuman conditions of employment, very poor pay, and no security of jobs at all. And this is a pattern across the world, especially in Southeast Asia. In Malaysia, the reports from Malaysia, South Korea, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka are very graphic in their description of how women are actually, on the one hand, filling the factories in unprecedented numbers, but in other ways being exploited as they have never been before.
And yet you have international organizations that are supposed to be working in conjunction with the United Nations, for example, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and yet these organizations are, as you put in your report, they're very much going in the opposite direction for the advancement of women. Let's put this question to Jocelyn Dow. She is with Red Thread Women's Development Project in Guyana, also on the executive committee of the Women's Environment and Development Organization. Maybe you can use the example of your own country.
Well, first of all, when you say that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank are working in connection with the UN, it's to mix, in a sense, oranges and apples, because though they may be in the same fruit bowl, in a sense, the best tendencies of the UN are entirely opposite to the best tendencies of the IMF. The World Bank has, without doubt, I would say, liberalized its agenda and certainly a lot of its rhetoric. But to give you an example, let's say that all the conferences out of which the work on the CSW and the Beijing platform came, that cycle of conferences, are really an argument by civil society and people and the women's movement in particular, and happily WeDo has been in the forefront of this, using initially a lot of Bella's experience in negotiations when we started in 92. But those agendas are very about people and about what it needs to make lives sane, just ordinarily sane and livable. They're not centered around money. Certainly that's not what the women bring to those discussions. The IMF and the World Bank of course, because they are quote-unquote macroeconomic, are dealing with money, profit, and a generation of quote-unquote wealth. And I can tell you that though there are arguments that in globalization and liberalization that we're going to have a lot more wealth for everyone, as we can see, and you can see in your own country, that a lot of the wealthy get wealthier, and a lot of the poor get poorer. Some, if you're in a lucky country, you may get better off for a while. And that's our experience at home. Frankly, if you're at 1% and you make 100% increase, you're at 2%. But if you need to be at 90%, so what? So that what has happened in many countries is, as you say, more jobs are given. People do actually have more employment, but the quality of life quite often is much worse. And the expectation level is quite different. And that is one of the things that we attempt to bring to these discussions at the UN, our concrete experiences in countries where the opposite obtains.
Jocelyn Dow is with the Red Thread Women's Development Project in Guyana. She's also a vice president of WEDU, which is the Women's Environment and Development Organization, founded by Bella Abzug, former Congress member from New York, internationally renowned feminist. They join us along with a number of other women today at this roundtable discussion of women's progress around the world. We've also so far heard from Bharati Sadashivam, who is the editor of the report put out by WEDU called Mapping Progress, Assessing Implementation of the Beijing Platform 1998, 3 years after the Beijing Women's Conference in China. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by women from Brazil, from Nigeria, as well as a continued conversation with our guests now. Stay with us. You are listening to Angelique Kidjo singing Batonga here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! On the second day of Women's History Month. We're sitting around the kitchen table of former Congress member Bella Abzug, who is also president of WEDU, the Women's Environment and Development Organization. Later today, she and a group of women from the executive board of WEDU will be at the United Nations before the Commission on the Status of Women, making a status report on women around the world. It's a report that's out now. We'll give out the number later in the show where you can get it, called Mapping Progress, Assessing Implementation of the Beijing Platform. Before we move on to Nigerian Chief Bisi Ogunlaya of Nigeria, I wanted to ask Jocelyn Dow one more question. Jocelyn Dow, who is from Guyana with the Red Thread Women's Development Project.
Now, in your country right now, it's different from a lot of countries in the world in that you've just elected a woman president, Janet Jagan. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, as you know, that entire process is mired in controversy, and we have an international accord. One of the things that we were discussing in this meeting is that, in fact, if women are going to take part in and be leaders in countries, we, as you know, Guyana, it's no secret, is on the verge of a lot of post-electoral trauma. And what we need to do is we need to, as women, have agendas that cross the political lines. So when there are issues, such as have arisen in Guyana, that you should be able to fall back, I would say, on women's movement or a women's broad-based agenda across partisan party lines that should be able to help you to resolve some of these issues as are obtaining in Guyana. And that's, I mean, part of the work I think that women have to do in promoting women in political office.
I'd like to bust in here, if I may, a little, and try to make sure that we have a full perspective about this report. It is really quite phenomenal that so many governments and so many women have participated in actually implementing a UN plan of action,
Bella,
which is
Abzug.
Most unusual, you see. And women are growing as a result of it. And the election of a woman and a flawed system is going to possibly, you know, be difficult to overcome. But the more women participate, the more they're going to be presidents. And the more women show that they are making a difference in agenda, the more they're going to help to change their own country's programs, their own country's perspectives, and the world's. And it's important to know that in all, as I said before, all my experience has been absolutely inspired by this response to Beijing. There's a consciousness, there's a pressure, there's a growing strong movement underneath which is saying to governments, you can no longer just talk to not act. And more women are going to be out there giving leadership, and I think it's desperately needed.
Bharati Sadashivam, again, the editor of the WeDo report called Mapping Progress.
To add to what Bella was just saying, what's been really interesting in this report is not the numbers of women that are actually in politics. You know, numbers, as I told you, don't always tell the full story, but the trend that we're seeing in many countries of women forming alliances with women in power to bring about actual changes on the ground. And this has happened in Korea, where in South Korea, where women have worked with nine female lawmakers that have come into parliament from the women's movement, and they have actually been instrumental in getting across domestic violence law into parliament. And the same trends are visible in Mexico, where women politicians are making cross-party alliances. They don't care what their party affiliation is. They just want to make sure that they keep women's priorities in sight. It's also happening in Japan, where the women parliamentarians have taken the lead from the Stockholm Congress and against commercial sexual exploitation of children, and they are pressing the government to bring about a law to ban commercial sexual exploitation in Japan. So I think what's really important to emphasize is that the Beijing process and the sort of the way it has created a groundswell of change and, you know, movement that women's groups everywhere are finding, are giving voice to what has been their aspiration for generations, and how a lot of the politicians now find it really politically difficult to ignore a lot of the women's agendas. And I think that's what's happening in countries that, even in many countries in Africa, in Mali, the first multi-party elections were held in 1996. And the number of women went up from 3 to 18 because the women made sure that every party fielded a certain number of women candidates. So even though the political quota is not a law, the Mali example shows that women have a role to play as long as they push the frontiers and make sure that people will speak for them in positions of power, even if they are not there themselves.
I think Chief Bisi in Nigeria can tell us of a very interesting process called the 100 Circles.
100 Women Group.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and today, on the second day of Women's History Month, we're taking a look at a major report that is being presented today at the United Nations called Mapping Progress, Assessing Implementation of the Beijing Platform 1998. And we turn now to Chief Bisi Agunlaya, who is Vice President and Coordinator of Country Women Association of Nigeria, also known as COWIN. Now, what is this group called?
The group that we are talking about is called the 100 Women Group Strategy. You see, when you talk about women in politics, or you are talking about women taking up leadership, the question is, why was it that women were not there initially? Why are women just fighting for it now? we realize that there's so many things that have been the obstacles. And one of it is what one of the speakers said earlier. The women had no constituencies of their own for a long time. You see, in politics, when a man wants to become anything, you have the old boys to fall upon. You have your co-partners in business to fall upon. But our women, who are capable leaders, even who could do better, they have no such people to fall upon. And the 100 women working group strategy is to prepare such constituency, to form that what you call women caucus. Because traditionally, taking Nigeria as an example, women being in politics is not a strange thing. In the olden days, the Aba Riot women asked the missionaries who gave them right to pass law on tax when they did not ask the Nigerian women. And they thought the women were kidding. But when the missionaries found out the women were serious, they quickly changed the law. But that was possible because of that caucus nature of the women. The time they will talk, you don't know. The traditional African women, they act before they speak. And that beauty, we don't have it again. So we organize this strategy so as to create a ground for our women politicians so that if anything like the one Ghana is experiencing happened, they have 100 women at community level, 100 women at local level, 100 women at provincial level, 100 women at state level, and 100 women, which we are now forming into a parliamentary forum for the rural women to fall upon. That is creating space for women leadership.
Now, in Nigeria, which is the most populous country in Africa, you're also now under a military dictatorship of Sani Abacha. What kind of political space do you have to operate? I mean, just 2 years ago, you had Kudirat Abiola, the wife of Chief Abiola, who's currently in prison, who, by all assessments, should have been president of Nigeria. She was gunned down on the streets of Lagos because of her outspokenness, believed to be gunned down by military working with the Sani Abacha regime.
When Bella was speaking, she mentioned in many cases women were not there when the laws were made in the past. Women must try, and that is what Beijing said. We were waiting for men to invite us. No military man will invite you for anything. They even don't invite men. Therefore, the Beijing have given the women the power because even though it's a military government, they came from Africa with more women to attend Beijing conference. And they made up promises for education, promises for credit, for land, for the poor people. And when we went back home, we have right, even though they are military government, we held them up for their own commitment at Beijing. The space is there. We only have to create it. It is within Nigeria, during Abacha, that they allow these 100 women groups. And when somebody was talking, she mentioned the issue of globalization. And that area is very important to me. You see, in Africa, women are the food producers. But now you want to globalize agriculture, food production, who will bear the brunt? It's the women. The report is very right. Because if you ask the rich people to come and put money into agriculture, produce the food crops, they will produce it for exporting and not for food. Therefore, we are talking of hunger in Nigeria, in Africa. If we allow this type of globalization to go on, more people will soon go on streets without food, I assure you.
So how do you fight it?
The way we are doing is to try and make sure the women come together and tell government that we don't want this. And women are finding a way of speaking, either through the ministry or by inviting officials to our meetings.
when I said chief, a lot of people must have expected we had a man in the room. How did you become a chief, Chief BC?
I'm a woman, I'm not a man. I'm happy you say that. I'm a chief because in my own tribe, if your father allowed, you can inherit the chieftaincy from him. And I inherited the chieftaincy, the traditional chieftaincy from my father.
Which tribe is that?
Yoruba. And apart from that, if you do any great work in the community for community development, the people recognize it and give you chieftaincy title. Mm-hmm.
You know, Amy, the
Bella Abzug.
The feature that has been different in this era of the 90s at the UN has been a women's caucus in which women organized and brought in women, especially we do, because we have been initiating and running the caucuses, women from all over the world, so that there is a place and a space where women can present their diversity and the things they're interested in. And that caucus is what is really being described and a different manifestation of it by the chief for rural political organizing. And one of the reasons I think we're at the stage that we're at now where we can produce pressure on government and have government have to respond with legislation and executive action and agendas is because the women's movement has developed this caucus method, both on the local level, the state levels, and the national levels, in which we've been able to put together the collective strength and be able to even, believe this or not, change the thinking and the policies at the United Nations. And now Thais Corral from Brazil, Herede, and who was also our vice president, has a mother who was just elected to the city council, for example. There's been that kind of outgrowth and that from the bottom up because women are organizing caucuses on every level. And why don't you tell us a little more about that?
Thais Corral is executive director of REDE, which is Network for Human Development in Brazil. Tell us about what's happening in Brazil, and what is this about your mother's election?
Yes, the thing is that after Beijing, one of the main breakthroughs in Brazil after the dictatorship that lasts until the year of 1985 was the fact that we decentralized as much as possible in our new constitution how policy, the process of making policy. And after policymaking, yeah, and after Beijing, one of the things we thought would reinforce our efforts to put gender, to strengthen gender in this structure that already exists, was a big campaign to elect women locally. And in this way, my mother also got elected as well as about 40,000 women. We have 5,000 municipalities in the country. So the cities, almost in every city, we have at least 4 or 5 women elected.
In which city is your mother a city council member now?
It's called Macaé. It's in the north part of the Rio de Janeiro state. That's the second biggest state of Brazil.
And what kind of platform did she run on?
She is actually the secretary for social development, and her platform was mainly to strengthen the role of women and people in the councils for health, in the council for environment, and the council for education. And this is somehow, as Bella said, a way of help and make people, facilitate people to exercise power, grassroots actually, to exercise power at the local level, at their own realities.
Did you attend the Beijing conference?
Yes, I did.
What kind of difference did it make for you in these last 3 years?
I think it made a difference, not only for me, but for all of us that somehow were engaged in the process, is that we start to understand and actually to experience what it means to be part of governance. And And for me, it was a learning process, a very deep learning process, that now we are engaged in the work of my organization to replicate through methodologies such as campaigns and radio, because we work with radio also in Brazil with a local Agenda 21 that is also a methodology to strengthen women's participation at the local level in decision making.
What do you mean by that, using radio? What do you do?
We have a network of women's radio programs around the country. So we train them. We actually try to enforce the gender perspective on radio programs.
We're talking to Thais Corral, who is executive director of REDE, Network in Defense of Humankind, based in Brazil. She's also on the board of the Women's Environment and Development Organization, WEDO, which is presenting today at the United Nations a status report on women called Mapping Progress, Assessing Implementation of the Beijing Platform. We'll give the phone number out later of where you can get this report. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. In addition to Thais Corral, we're speaking to Chief Bisi Ogunlaye, who is coordinator of Country Women Association of Nigeria, Jocelyn Dow of the Red Thread Women's Development Project in Guyana, and Bella Abzug, former congressmember and co-founder of the Women's Environment and Development Organization. The editor of the report is Bharati Sadashivam, and we're going to come back to her in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue today with this full program discussion on the status of women around the world, in looking at the whole picture of the report Mapping Progress, there are a number of areas that you deal with. Among these areas, globalization, which we've talked a little about, the issue of women in office, one of the places where women have gone down in office, although it sounds like in many places women, there have been more women in office, is in Eastern Europe, actually, in the communist bloc countries, the former communist bloc countries. Bharati Sadashivam, could you explain that phenomenon?
Well, I think what's happening in the Eastern Bloc countries is that there was very specific quota allocations and sort of egalitarian policies followed under the communist system, where certain numbers of women had to be elected to policy making and electoral bodies, which has changed in the general open democratic process. But I think the shock has been the most. Certainly in the Eastern European countries, but what's also interesting to see is that there is quite a vibrant movement of civil society in many of these countries, especially Croatia, Bulgaria, even Russia, where women have very strong critiques of what governments are doing and how they can do better. This report in particular highlights the activities of women in these countries.
I can add to that Bella, it's not so easy to transfer a social society into a market economy. And women, unfortunately, have borne the brunt of that transition. There's, tremendous unemployment. The social programs which they had, they no longer have. And it has affected their power. And there has to be some much deeper analysis of how you make change in government from one system to another without making one group, which in this case, again, is women, be the victims.
Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the issues that is addressed in this report, and especially through the issue of globalization, is that as you're talking about women having more involvement in government, corporations are gaining more power, and they are dictating the way, the landscape of countries. Now, how do women deal with this? Jocelyn Dow, Executive Director of the Red Thread Women's Development Project in Guyana.
I think one of the things I'd like to see happily that we do has really struggled to do at all levels, especially from the Earth Summit to now, is to show that to advance macroeconomic gains or profit-centered gains at the expense of women in society is in fact not to advance at all. And I think that if you look at the reports and the work that we've been doing and the several reports, is what you will notice is though women are more active and more vocal and are trying to take more command of, I would say, governance, that you are fighting, in fact, on many other fronts. The fronts that have to do with new economic methodologies, which is the company versus the state. And in fact, unfortunately, you could hold a state more responsible than you can hold a company. And the real, for me as a person from the Caribbean, the real advocacy and the reason I'm so glad to be part of an organization that is as politically clear as we do, because there are a lot of women's organizations that are not as, for me, as politically clear as we do. And I think we have benefited tremendously from Bella's historical role, a political role, is that what you come to our agenda with is a very clear understanding that this struggle is multifaceted. Women have to hold their views, not to enter into the arena and behave like men, right? And that is quite often what happens in the political transition, so to speak. And I think when Bella was talking about a deeper analysis of what the politics of change is about, whether it's change from one ideology to another or one system of profit or economic system, is that women must have an internal agenda as women in all societies in which they are oppressed and usually at the bottom of all societies. Women are at the bottom of all societies. We're the poorest of the poor worldwide, and we have the least access to resources. And it's that unity and that commonality of our otherness from those systems that we are building on in WeDo, and trying to use that to advocate for a world in which those things are corrected and women are really central to the decision making, so that we in fact bring a human-centered agenda to development.
One of the sentences in the conclusion of the report says, where national action plans remain more plans than action, the reasons for lack of progress are many. The weakness of democratic political institutions, the absence of a vigorous civil society, the resurgence of right-wing forces implacably opposed to women's rights to equality and freedom, profligate defense spending, the devastation of armed conflicts and the aftermath of war, and the constraints imposed by a voracious global economy and austerity measures for debt servicing. Now, I wanted to touch on one of those, profligate defense spending. We are now in a situation where there is a military buildup in the Gulf. At this point, 25,000 U.S. troops are in the Gulf, and we don't know yet how the conflict with Iraq is going to conclude. But what about this issue of military spending at the expense of social spending?
Well, as you probably know, and as many in your audience know,
Bella Abzug,
a 5% cut, for example, in the United States military budget could provide a banquet for the world's $1.6 million poor. And this has to be constantly pressed as the military, as wasteful spending like that actually depletes society for everybody. It's incredible to recognize the fact that with all the world's resources, so on, and in this country, in the United States as well, that what we see is a widening gap between rich and poor. And that is, you know, intolerable wherever your ideology is and whatever party you're interested in, or no party. And what we're saying is that women believe in a transformational vision. We don't think of programs as to how we can, you know, slice a little here, get a little here, give back a little there, take from there. We're saying that there's something fundamentally wrong with societies that allow the military to subsume the common good, so to speak, and that what really is needed is a view of a world in which there is greater economic equity and a country, whatever your country is, where there is a way to solve issues peacefully. We saw this very interesting Nobel Prize given to a woman who organized in a grassroots fashion governments with respect to the issue of
landmines.
The people still have the power if it's organized and if it's understood. We have 20,000 women in our network. And what we're trying to do all over the world is to organize that power in a different way, that we say issues between governments can be solved peacefully, not through war, that the environment is a plus when one protects it and not as it now is, and that unless there is equality among people, especially between men and women, no real change will take place.
And yet, as is pointed out in this report on mapping progress, at the same time that everyone is organizing and there have been a lot of progress made, you've got these top secret negotiations going on around the multilateral agreement on investments, top secret, that could affect women's lives all over the world. For a moment, maybe, Jocelyn Dow, if you could explain what the MAI is, because they are so secret, most people don't know.
I just wanted to talk on a little thing that Bella mentioned and to say something about WeDo. Today in our discussions at the board, if I may, we deliberately added a new word to our mission statement, which has always been understood. And that was, it's not new, but it's been clarified in our mission statement. And Mim pointed it out. And I think it has to do with the ever-present sense of military buildups here, there, as they are in the world these days, and we added the word peace. We talked about a healthy and peaceful planet. And that is it. The multilateral investments, I think it's one of those things, again, that we're dealing with, where you can have, you talked about the World Trade Organization. Well, what those whole agenda of items say is that anything you trade, money, goods, services, are now open to all, not only governments, but companies across nations, and that you are bound by one set of rules. So in other words, if I wanted to make a drink factory, to make it at its most ludicrous, in Guyana, a place with a population of 750,000 people, and I had a little bottling factory, that I would have to bid, say, against Coca-Cola. In other words, Coca-Cola would have the right to come into Guyana to bid on a contract. And I equally would have that right as my little company in a small, backward economy to come and bid in the United States. So obviously it's nonsense that you don't have parity and that the mighty shall bid and the weak shall be eaten up. And I think that that is part of that globalized agenda. Whilst you talk about equality, you can't take different things and make them equal because the rules are equal. And that's what we see with the military and with everything else.
Let me ask a quick question about specific women's health issues, female genital mutilation, and where women stand today, and also the issue of abortion around the world. Let's go to the editor of the report, Mapping Progress, Bharati Sadashivam.
The report highlights two or three important trends in the issue of female genital mutilation. The biggest headline, obviously, is the ban by the Egyptian government on of the practice. And the ban is significant, especially because the health minister issued
a decree which was challenged by the conservative groups in Egypt. But very interestingly, the Supreme Court upheld the minister's ruling and also said that nowhere in the Quran is this practice endorsed or legitimized. But I think it's also important to note what a lot of Egyptian women's rights groups and others have said, is that although the international concern and support by women's movements across the world for to ban these practices is important, it's also crucial to recognize that FGM cannot be isolated and picked out from what is a country's cultural ethos or health situation, because to talk about just FGM in Africa, any part of Africa, without looking at the health system as a whole, which denies women very basic health care at every level, is in a way sort of dramatizing an issue and sort of culturally, exoticizing it in a way. And I think a lot of women's groups have been very angered by some of the statements that have come out of the West on this subject. On the question of abortion, there have been 20 countries in this report which have talked about new laws and policies to address women's reproductive choice and freedom. And one of the most dramatic breakthroughs has been in South Africa, where there's been a choice, reproductive choice on pregnancy, a termination of pregnancy act, which has come about largely, again, because of fantastic mobilizing by the Reproductive Rights Alliance of South Africa, which has fought for to make this possible, to give women the right to abortion on demand within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. And it's supposed to be a historical move, historic first in all of Africa. But at the same time, you have the case of Poland, which is an example of how an overall conservative milieu can set back women's gains. Just in 1996, the new Polish government had liberalized the abortion law, and then you have a very conservative government that came into power in 1997, and the first thing it did was to reverse it completely. So now abortion is illegal again in Poland, and this has happened within a year.
Well, I'm going to give the last word to Chief B.C. Ogunlaya of Nigeria. She's coordinator of Country Women Association of Nigeria, known as COWAN, today on the second day of Women's History Month.
People talk of poverty eradication. We find out that people are not consistent. That is the problem that women movement are facing, and we are trying to develop a strategy of making government all over the world be consistent on whatever promises they made for women. Today, you see the industrial countries who are talking about eradication of poverty, like she quickly described. They are the people who could go to the poor countries to set up whatever farm, whatever industry they want in a better form, and whatever they produce, they are going to import it or to export it to other places, and the people inside the country will be poorer. Whereas those people from the same country could not go to the Western country to set up, how can somebody from Nigeria come and set up a business to compete with Bella? I cannot compete with Bella in New York. So, but Bella can compete and beat me up in Nigeria. I mean, this is what we are talking of as globalization. There is no economic injustice when you look at the whole thing. And the women movement all over the world, we are working so hard on it, talking with the World Bank, talking with IMF, talking with even our national government to make sure that time has arrived for economic justice.
Well, I want to thank you very much all for joining us. Chief B.C. Ogunlaye, coordinator of Country Women Association of Nigeria. Jocelyn Dow, executive director of Red Thread Women's Development Project in Guyana. Thais Corral, executive director of REDE, which is a network in defense of humankind based in Brazil. We've also been joined by Bharati Sadashivam, editor of the report Mapping Progress, Assessing Implementation of the Beijing Platform, and Congresswoman, former Congresswoman Bella Abzug of New York, well-known international feminist and co-founder and president of Women's Environment and Development Organization, known as WEDO. It's an international advocacy network working to achieve social, political, economic, and environmental justice through the empowerment of all women. If you'd like a copy of the report, you can call 212-973-0325. That's 212-973-0325. This report, Mapping Progress, is being presented today at the United Nations. The website is www.wedo.org. That's www.wedo.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with Hisu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our engineer, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!